All right, we have before us House File 1577, Representative Erickson's bill. There are some pieces of information up there that may help. This is rather a complicated issue, and we're going to try and wade through this in the next 45 minutes. All right, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'd like to move House File 1577 to be before the committee, recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. As many of you know, I am a bit creative, but not as creative as one of my superintendents. Dr. Fred Nolan began these discussions with me about 9 months ago and brought House research from taxes and education together, held a couple of conferences, hosted meetings during the summer, because of the concern that we have about the sales ratio and about debt equalization. So what this bill, in a nutshell, does, it removes the effects of limited market value and green acres from the sales ratio calculation for school district debt service equalization and calculations. The net effect of this change is to lower the tax bases used to calculate debt service levies and increase debt service equalization aid for those school districts with large amounts of property subject to limited market value for green acres. And that's as much as I'm going to mention because Dr. Fred Nolan, superintendent of Foley Public Schools, is here. And at his right is Steve Hins, who is House Research for Taxes. And then Tim Strom has been so gracious through this whole process to help me and to assist Dr. Nolan and other superintendents and other interested school officials in trying to figure out how this might work for the state of Minnesota. So later on, Mr. Strom will also address this. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Nolan. Do you want to scoot over and I'll be?
Would you please also introduce yourself distinctly for our tape?
Yes. Fred Nolan, Superintendent of Schools, Foley, Minnesota. And I'm really pleased to be here. Equalization is a very, very important principle in Minnesota. And the idea is that people's tax effort should produce roughly the same outcomes of education across the state of Minnesota. And so if you look at the very first slide on the PowerPoint, in which it says, is the current ANTC still the gold standard for equalizing state aid for debt equalization formula and maximum effort rate? People should sit up and pay attention, because the ANTC is what all the equalization formulas are based on. And if there's a distortion or a slight flaw in that basis, all the subsequent equalization formulas are going to be off by that much. And with me here is Steve Hines, who has done a lot of work on this, Tim Strom, and also when I'm finished, various education groups, C and MSBA and MREA, would like to add a few comments at the very end. What we're going to do today is go through what is ANTC. I mean, we talk about it a lot, but really, what is it? How is it currently calculated? What's the role of the sales ratio in all this? What is that number that comes out to schools every summer? And here's the really critical question. Once we've got those first three terms defined, how does limited market value distort ANTC and therefore the application of the debt aid formula and the maximum for capital loan formula? Mm-hmm. And can ANTC be reformed to remove the effects of limited market value? Those last, that third, fourth question is really the critical one today. And we will have a proposal that answers the last question. To study these issues, we held a conference this summer. And I can tell you, you have some wonderful civil servants in the state of Minnesota who came up to Foley July 29th, when everybody else is probably vacationing, and met together. And it was the first time that county assessors, the Department of Revenue, legislative analysts, and the Department of Education had ever gotten together and looked at the sales ratio in ANTC from beginning to end, from when the assessor goes out to see the property or deals with the assessment at his level or her level, all the way through when Tom Melcher figures out the aid that gets sent out to the school districts. And you know Tim Strom, Steve Hines is here. I want to point out that Leonard Peterson over at the Department of Revenue has been very helpful, very kind, very good person. So the reform effort grew from these this conference, and we have been to see the commissioner. We've been to see various chairmen of committees, and their input has been helpful. And again, the work of Steve Hines and Tim Strom has been essential to this. So let's start with what is adjusted net tax capacity. The school's finance formulas are use sales ratio to form an adjusted net tax capacity district to district, county to county, across the entire state of Minnesota. And currently it's adjusted net tax capacity equals net tax capacity, which is what people actually pay their taxes on. The valuation you actually pay on is what's called net tax capacity, as you combine that into a governmental unit like a school district. And the equalization valuation is the adjusted net tax capacity. So the sales ratio has a real critical role there, because you divide the sales ratio into the net tax capacity. Well, what is that? Well, the sales ratio is what happens with the assessor's market value or limited value, whichever is lower, divided by the sales price. And the sales price is determined by what are called sales ratio studies. These are up to 21-month studies done by the Department of Revenue for school districts. They look for at least 6 sales in each property classification. If they have 6 sales, they determine that a good sale number. And then they compare that number, that value, to either the assessor's market value or limited market value. In fact, they divide, they take and divide the limited market value by the sales value. So we'll have an example a little bit later. We'll see what happens. But your sales ratio in the state of Minnesota last year's ranged from 0.54, the lowest, which was McGregor, Minnesota, to 1.06, which was in Climax. That's a 2-to-1 ratio. And that's fundamental to ANTC. So that spurred me to ask, what's going on here? Why should there be that kind of a swing? General uses the sales ratio studies, and the Department of Revenue will continue to do these. These are essential to equalization across the state. And sales ratio studies are used by assessors in the counties for all these purposes. In fact, there's an assessor here today if you'd like to ask him more about that. He was intrigued and came to this hearing. The sales ratio studies are also used by oversight agencies. They provide technical assistance. And to equalize across the state, first you have the direct equalization by the State Board of Equalization, which Leonard Peterson tells me they're doing less and less of because there's more computerized work, and indirect equalization through school formulas. ANTC is an indirect equalization, the use of a sales ratio, and also tax court. In tax court, the sales ratio studies are Minnesota's and assessor's best defense that they have accurately valued the property. So sales ratio studies will continue, the sales ratio will continue to be used, but how is the sales ratio calculated for schools is what we're asking today. So now the effect of sales ratio and debt levy. Debt levy is the primary levy affecting schools right now. There are a number of others which we'll get to way at the end of the slide, but this is the big one. Since the general ed formula in 2001 was taken off the property tax rolls. And since only districts that are relatively property poor qualify for debt aid, those districts are most impacted. There's 120 districts throughout the state that receive state debt aid, and plus 20 capital loan districts. So we're talking about 140 districts out of 345. So keep that number in mind. And the effect is even more pronounced for maximum for capital loan districts, of which Foley is a member, because our repayment amount to the state is based on ANTC. The state sets the rate at which the loan is to be repaid, and it sets the amount that rate is multiplied by. And so for maximum for capital loan districts, this is that have a high degree of limited market value, this is a major problem. And it's success rated by limited market value. Okay, so what's limited market value? Limited market value was created by the legislature as a way to slow the growth of property tax, and it's a tool to slow down the rate of growth. Now, I believe it started out at an 8% number, grew to a 12% number, 15%. Now I think it's at a 25% number in terms of the amount of growth that is allowed. Another form of limited market value is green acres, which primarily affects districts where farmland is being purchased for future development. According to current law, limited market value is set to be phased out. Okay, Green Acres is not. And you see the note there of what happened in Benton County. the assessor in Benton County, in doing his duty of public information, sent out to 1,800 landowners representing 4,000 parcels the notice about Green Acres. And of those, that comprises 50% of the parcels in the Foley School District. Now, I don't know how many of those people will qualify for Green Acres, but this is a statutory process to prevent farmers landowning taxes by pushing them out of business. We're not saying there's anything wrong with limited market value. What we're saying is, does limited market value should limited market value in any way affect the school debt equalization formula and the maximum for capital loan rate? So another question is, will limited market value be extended? We've had conversations with many legislators who say, yeah, there's quite a bit of pressure. People out there who would like to see this extended. So while currently it's set to sunset, the question is will it? And I refer you to an article in the Minneapolis Tribune from January 28th that specifically quotes several legislators on that issue. So limited market value distorts the sales ratio. And because the sales ratio is computed by converting the limited market value of property to its actual sales price, a taxing jurisdiction with a significant number of limited market values will lead to a higher ANPC because there's a bigger gap between the actual taxable amount and the sale. So therefore, the ANPC is going to go up in those districts. And since this increase, the district's levy share of equalized finance formulas and raises the total tax bill. That's the impact of it. Now I'm going to show you four examples of school districts. And any school district in the state, you can encourage your superintendent to call Leonard Peterson. He will send this information out to them. There are six or seven property classifications. And in each classification, you actually have the relationship between the actual sales price and the taxable value. What is the net tax capacity? And I'm going to start here with Foley. Residential property classification, the sales ratio is 83.9. In other words, the taxable value by the assessor, either with limited market value or strictly by the assessor, was 83% of the sales of the recent sales study. Not bad. Not great, but not bad. But if you look over at farms with buildings, it's 59.3%. Now, the assessor in Benton County tells me that's not where he's assessing those properties. He's assessing about the same ratio as the housing. He knows what the values of those properties. But because so many farms are being, the value is going up so quickly due to speculation about development, the limited market value for farms in our district is 59.3%. That gives us a sales ratio of 70%. In Barnum, which is up toward Duluth, the residential property is 76% of its sales, current sales, and has some limited market value in there. Leonard Peterson in July told me they're thinking about breaking out residential property into two classifications, residential and residential on water, because so many of the cabins are being turned into year-round residences, and those values are going up so much, it distorts the picture of what residential looks like. So they're actually thinking over there about making another classification. But if you look at the seasonal rec, their sales ratio is 59% of the actual sales, so the net tax capacity of those properties is only 59% of the sales study for the last 21 months in that district. They come out to a sales ratio of 71%. Rush City, which does not have a maximum for capital loan but does have debt aid, you head up Highway 35 toward Hinckley. Residents, 70.5, not bad. Look at the farms, 33.5. There's so much speculation going on there about growth that the net tax capacity of farms with buildings is only 33% of the recent sales studies. And I'm sure that the assessor in that county is doing his job. With computers, these guys and gals are doing a good job across the state of Minnesota. It's due to limited market value. We'll actually show you district by district across the state the effect of limited market value. Annandale, just a little west of the cities, same sort of issue. Residents, 80% of recent sales, not bad. The assessor's doing pretty keeping up pretty close. Look what happens in seasonal recreation. It's not that all of a sudden the assessor went brain dead. This is a limited market value due to the fast increasing value of lakeshore property very close to the Twin Cities. So statewide, 120 school districts received debt service aid. The median sales ratio is 80%. The median effective limited market value is 28.2%. The maximum effective limited market value on is 72%. One district, 72% of the sales ratio is due to limited market value. Think for a minute where you think the fastest change in property values are. You got an idea in mind? It's Dover, Iota, just east of Rochester. Makes sense to me. The maximum effect is zero. The minimum effect is zero. There are a number of districts where there's no limited market value. Sale of property is not changing rapidly. The most effective types of districts are seasonal rec and residential, and would have farm and seasonal rec. At this time, I'm going to pause and ask the staffer for House Research on Taxes, Steve Hines, to go through with you a portrait handout you have of sales ratios district by district. So Steve, if you do that for me.
Sure.
Mr. Hines.
Yes, Madam Chair. I was going to just talk a little bit about the handout you have, that portrait format handout, a vertical handout. At the top of it says 2003 school district sales ratios used for payable 2005 school aid amounts. It's like this. And
simpler. Here's a more complicated one.
Buried you in paper today.
It doesn't have columns like one of them does, yeah. But it's still an up and down.
On this printout, it lists the maximum effort districts first, and then other affected districts, which are districts that are in some way eligible for debt service aid. And this could be computed for all school districts, but we're only focused on the debt levy here, so I didn't do it. But any of your districts might be interested to know what this breakdown is. But the first column shows the sales ratio that's now being used for the district, or was used for payable 2005 school aids. And you'll see this focus on the first city on the list, I think, 70. Hill City District with a sales ratio of 73.2%. Now, we asked the Department of Revenue to also compute sales ratio under the alternative formulation that's called for in House File 1577, and they were able to determine the sales ratios computed in that way, and you'll see then the second column shows what those sales ratios would be. In all cases, those are higher or the same than the first column. And so in Hill City's case, 80.1%. And so what that is saying is if we look at the relationship between sale price and limited value in column one, we see that Hill City, on average, is at about 73%. Each time a property sells, the average relationship between the taxable value and the sale price is 73%. So about 27% of the property is sort of not in the tax base. I might get into trouble with some of these formulations of statements, so I may have to back off them. But whereas if you had done it using the estimated market value, you would find that the sales price is 80%. Now, maybe I should drop back a step. Estimated market value is the value that the assessor thinks the property is worth, or the value that he thinks it's worth without having to take into account the limitation required under LMV. So the next two columns then sort of try to break out the underassessment, and that's, again, not a good word to use, but I was trying to illustrate the point. Sort of like, how much is the deviation from an ideal 100% sales ratio? How much is due to the two factors? One is how much the assessor kind of is on average missing the assessment by, and how much is the is being missed of the value because of LMV. So in Hill City's case, the 80%, the overall sales ratio is 73%. So it's sort of like 27% of the tax base is missing in the way we're characterizing it here. Three quarters of that, 74%, is due to underassessment. 25%, 26% is due to LMV. Now, if you go down the list of districts, you'll see that the relationship between those two factors varies quite a bit. And I think the point of the legislation is that one of the items to keep in mind is that in some ways the last column, the part due to LMV, does not really reflect an assessor's not keeping up to speed on the assessment. It reflects a state policy that says you cannot tax this property at its full value because of the limited market value law. The other column is more how much are assessors not capturing because of varying assessment practices across districts. And again, I'm kind of glossing over a number of different things that go under that level of underassessment that we could get into. But the idea is that those are two very different reasons for low sales ratios. I think, like, if you notice District 51, Foley, the fourth district on the list, I believe, you'll see that relationship is almost 50-50. So about half of the deviation from 100% is because of LMV, and only half is because of the assessment practices. I don't think I'll go through the rest of the list, but I would happily answer questions. But the idea is partly how variable it is and how big that last column is, how much of it can be due to limited market value.
Can I just ask you, why would the assessor be undervaluing them to this extent? Is that because you mentioned they're doing it by computer? Would that be why? But why would any assessor be undervaluing a property at 52% of its real value?
Madam Chair, when I'm calling something under assessment, I should add that assessors are trying to get into a range of 90% to 105%. So an assessor that was at 90%, we would typically consider to be right on the money, even though, you know, it's still not 100%. So again, that's why the term underassessment was useful for this exercise. It's not really quite the right term to use. But basically, as far as the part of it that they can control, the relationship between the EMV and the sales ratio, it's just the difficulty of the assessment practice, a process of trying to keep up with sales in an environment where prices are changing rapidly. The level of sophistication of the computer programs they have, the randomness of the market is another big factor where you can never really get sales ratios consistently to be close to 100 because there's always factors that go in that wouldn't show up in a computer program, I think.
Mr. Hines, we have a question from Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Hine. I was just wondering, as far as the underassessment is concerned, is there any kind of pattern here as far as where the underassessment is more pronounced? Is it more pronounced in higher property valued areas, lower property valued areas, or is it pretty much the same, or is it pretty mixed?
Madam Chair, Representative Easton,
Mr. Hine.
I wasn't really prepared to make a very general statement about that, but clearly when you look at the sales ratio that we're using now, the one that does have both of these sort of factors into play, the assessor's error and the limited market value, you find that the limited market value based sales ratio tends to be lower in rural areas that are dominated by agricultural and seasonal recreational properties, largely because those properties are the ones that are inflating the most, have the most limited value. They're also probably a little harder to assess because of the market is less predictable. Residential are probably the easiest thing to keep track of. There's usually a big base of them. There's not as much variability between properties. In urbanized areas, it's a lot easier, that are dominated by homes, it's a lot easier to keep up to be fairly uniform in your assessment. Well, that's a very general statement. As far as looking at the specifics, I haven't really done that.
Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Hines, thank you. And I was wondering, I understand the limited market value. Obviously, it's going to be lower in those areas where you have, you know, recreational property, farmland. I was wondering about the underassessment due to the assessor, if you see any pattern there as far as differences.
Madam Chair, Representative Eichen.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you eyeball these, you know you're part of the state, you can see it's neither places where it's poor or wealthy, it's where it's changing fastest. Okay, so if you look at Kellyer, which is the second one on the list, there is a lot of property up there being bought up for hunting land. So what used to be kind of waste woodland is now being bid up for hunting property. You go down to the other affected district, Centennial, which is basically a lot of small homes. Mr. Hines is correct. It's fairly easy for the assessor to keep up there. I think as you look down the list, the ones that are in the 70s, you can say that it's because, and I'm talking about the second column in, which is the assessor's practice, is where it's rapidly changing. And if you notice, that's also probably where they have the lowest current sales ratio, because there's also limited market value. So it's kind of a compounding effect. But it also points out why you don't want to go just to net tax capacity, because there is a need to equalize the assessor's practice across the state. We did look long and hard at going right to net tax capacity, but decided that because of the variation you see in that second column, if you really want to get equalization across the state of Minnesota, you do need to have the sales ratio create an ANTC, just maybe not the way it's currently calculated.
Thank you,
sir. If I may go on, Madam Chair?
Please.
Okay.
And I apologize for calling you Mr. Folding.
You're
from Folding.
I got it, yes.
Mr. Nolan.
I think I'm going to be known as Mr. Tax Capacity pretty soon here. Anyway, our solution is 1577, which has been entered by Representative Erickson. And what it does is simplify the calculation by simply saying we're going to take the assessor's market value, which you see everybody sees on their property tax statements, which they're getting currently as your estimated market value, and dividing that by the sales price, which is a more recent calculation of what are the sales prices of classifications of that property in your area. And this proposal removes the effective LMD from the sales ratio and frankly returns it to its original purpose, which was to equalize across the state of Minnesota for assessor practices, not to take into account a statutory requirement that limits the impact of rising property values on people's taxes. So I think this will make a little help if we go through these two examples. And I thank Tim Strom and Steve Hines for these examples. And with some trepidation, I'll lead you through these. They created a fictitious district that had a net tax capacity of $7,200,000, which is, of course, 1% of the actual valuation of that property, of that total district. The sales price of a typical home is $150,000. The assessor has that home valued at $135,000, 80% of valuation. But because that was a much older home and it's been rising in value, let's assume it has a limited market value of $100,000. Okay. So now, if you take the current law, the homestead sales ratio for that taxable area is 66%. Let's just assume the assessor's got 90% on everything else. You come out with a sales ratio of 78% because you average those two. Well, you take 78% and divide that into, that's my sixth grade language, 7.2 million, and you come up with an ANTC of $9,191,000. Y'all with me on line H, left-hand column. Now, let's assume that district had 3,000 students, had an ANTC per pupil there of 3,063, has an annual debt payment of $2 million, which is quite high, but you need to have quite a bit of debt to qualify for debt aid in the current rules. Your debt service formula on Tier 1 is $26,000. That's your aid. And your levy is $1,973,000. Okay, let's take the tax on that $100,000 home. That's the $100,000 limited value home. That home would be paying $274. A tax on a $150,000 home, not subject to limited market value, would be $411, and a tax on a $50,000 business would be $616. That's current law. That's current law the way it's correctly applied. Now, our proposal, 1577, goes down the right-hand side. Same A, B, C, D, same basic assumptions about the district, but now the homestead sales ratio would be 90%, and the sales ratio for annual property is going to be 90, and the sales rate for the whole district would be 90. We're just assuming the assessor's at 90%, okay? If he was at 85%, it would just adjust the numbers a little bit, but let's assume it's at 90, which is the gold standard for assessors. Well, then, you take 90% and divide it into 7,000,002, you come up with $8 million for ANTC. Now you start working the district numbers in there, and you'll see line L, the aid has gone to $133,000. The aid's gone up over $100,000 to that district simply by taking limited market value out of the formula, out of what the basis for ANTC is. So let's see what the taxes would be. Line N on that $100,000 home would be $259. $150,000 home without limited market value would be $388, and the business would be $583. So you can see that in the 120 districts, there would be change. Now, there's a run which we'll get to in a moment where you'll see the amount of change in each district. Some of zero, because they're very limited, very little limited market value. Some it's going to be quite a bit. Let's take a look at the maximum effort capital loan school districts. Here the state is setting both the entire tax bill for the district, both sides of the formula. In that district, we're going to start with all the same basic assumptions, $7.2 million, everything about the home. In the current law, the homestead ratio is 67%. Line G, the sales ratio for the district, let's assume is $78 million. Adjusted net cap is $9,991,000. Now, current law sets the tax rate at 32%. We've been in front of you for House File 0027, and it also is in the governor's bill to reduce that to 28% due to a glitch in 2001. We could talk about that, but that's not what I'm here to talk about today. The maximum for capital levy in that district would be $2,941,000. That is what the state says to the district. You must collect those in taxes and aid. That actual rate would be 40%. If you take the $2,009,000 and divide it back into $7,002,000, because actually you can only tax the $7,002,000. So if the state bill is $2,009,000, that rate that was supposed to be 32% is now 40%. The max per capita loan, the home at $100,000 pays $409,000, $150,000 home $613,000, $150,000 business is $919,000. Now, just notice the two sheets. These numbers are quite a bit higher than a standard debt. So the districts that are getting loans are not getting a free deal. They really are paying a high rate, a maximum rate, because they needed help initially. But let's take a look at the right-hand side. 1577 would propose, let's go with what the assessor's valuation is, 90%. You come up with an $8 million adjusted net tax capacity. 32% of that is $2,005,000. You divide that into the $7,002,000 and you get a rate on line K of 35.5%. Quite a drop. And then the taxes on the homes, the $100,000 home would be $356, $150,000 home would be $533, and the business would be $800. And all we did was take LMV, which is a statutory requirement, out of the calculation for ANTC and said, let's focus simply on what the assessors have. And so at this point, I'd like to go to the landscape sheet and ask either Steve Hines or Tim Strom to lead you through this. At the top, it says debt service levies under alternate proposal, taxes payable 2005. The front page is only maximum for capital loan districts, so maybe what we should do is flip over to the next page first and deal with the 120 school districts, starting with Centennial at the top, because there's more districts in that grouping, and then go back to the maximum effort. I think that'd be a cleaner way to explain this. So, gentlemen,
I'll, Madam Chair, I will start and welcome Tim to jump in, or Fred for that matter. The printout that Mr. Nolan has been referring you to shows in the first set of columns the current law as it affects the debt service levy in those districts, the affected districts, not maximum effort districts. You see at the top a total aid amount to those districts of $18.6 million, levy of $110.5 million, and the tax rates, and this is in terms of the district's tax base on a $125,000 home in each district. The middle set of columns then would be the situation that would be in effect for under House File 1577. And you can see district by district what the effects are. In aggregate now, in the middle columns, instead of saying the total amount of aid or the total amount of levy, we just are showing the change. So there are be an additional $3.47 million of aid paid to those districts, because this was what House Bill 1577 is doing, is basically saying that each district has less tax base wealth than they have under the current law. The EMV sales ratios are higher sales ratios, and a higher sales ratio means a lower, you know, equalized tax capacity. So because of the lower amounts of property values, we see this $3.5 million or so additional aid to those districts, and conversely, the same dollar drop in their levies, $3.5 million. You can see how that plays out district by district and how it translates in for the tax on a specific home at $125,000. At a home of different value, the effects would just be scaled to whatever that value would be. The final set of numbers then on these two pages is a different version of 1577, whereby if you were not just trying to do this in a way where you didn't spend any additional state dollars, so that the parameters of the program were adjusted to make the program revenue neutral. And in this case, we see that the spending for these affected districts, we have a slight aid change of about an increase of $190,000, which is a little bit offset in the maximum effort districts to bring us closer to that zero. And you'll see that I think some districts are winners and some are losers in this under this kind of a circumstance, because if you have to make revenue neutral, the ones that benefit the most from the change in sales ratios are going to be still be better off. The ones who didn't perhaps have so much limited value and therefore aren't benefited as much by the sales ratio change could actually end up being a little worse off under this proposal. And you'll see that in the case of a district, St. Clair District number 75, I see is one where their aid would actually be reduced under that kind of a proposal and their levy increased. And I'm sure if we look back at their sales ratio, we could see why that was the case. So that's the page 2 and 3 then are the effect on the non-maximum effort districts. And then if you turn to the first page and focuses, and these are two different tables on the maximum effort districts. And unfortunately, maybe to add to the confusion, the layout of this page is a little different from pages 2 and 3. Because in this case, we were trying to show both the effects of going between current law and the 28% rate that's in House File 27, and then also the effect on adding 1577 on top of 27. So the first, the top half of the page shows for the maximum effort district the total aid and total levy under current law, the tax rate, etc. Then the middle columns at the top of the page are the same format as before, the aid change and the levy change, but this time under the 28% maximum effort rate, which, as you can see, does actually save the state about $500,000 and drops levies in those maximum effort districts by close to $2 million. Mm-hmm. Then on the far right on the table at the top of the page, we see that then this is the effect with 1577 added to 27. So really the effect of both bills. And in that case, you'll see that then that aid to maximum effort districts is up about 700,000 compared to current law, 684,000 to be exact. And the levy is reduced by about 3.5 million compared to current law. So again, on the columns to the right, some of that effect came about because of House File 27, which is shown in the middle, and the rest of it is House File 1577 on the right. Now, one thing to point out, especially about the aid change, is under House File 27, we see that aid would be down for maximum effort districts by about almost $500,000, $470,000. In the columns on the right, we see that aid is increased by, compared to current law, about $680,000. So that means that under 1577, not only did it sort of take away that $470 million of state savings from House File 28, but it actually added more aid on top of that. And if you'd measure just the effects of 1577, that would be about a $1.2 million increase in aid as a result of 1577 by itself, taking House File 27 into account. Finally, at the bottom of the page, the first two columns are the same, the current law and the maximum effort 28% rate. The column on the right there is the revenue neutral version of House File 1577, which is not before you now, but in working with Dr. Nolan on this project, we did also consider the possibility of trying to do this as a revenue neutral bill. And that, again, would show both winners and losers when you go to revenue neutral because you have to adjust the parameters to make sure it doesn't spend any additional money. I think I'll leave it at that unless there are questions on that. Hand over. Dr. Nolan has something to add.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Did a good job if everybody would see their district and see what the effect would be. Because we are proposing that the state assume the cost of this changeover, which is about $4.7 million. So there's no losers in this change to make a more equal formula. I think it'd be unfortunate to ask certain taxpayers to pay the burden of the fact that the formula has gotten a little out of whack through no fault of their own. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one more thing on the printout that we just talked about. At the end of page 3, there's the state total aid amounts are shown for both the maximum effort and the other districts, and it shows the two bills separately and together.
And if there's no questions on that sheet, then I'll move forward and continue the testimony.
Madam Chair.
How much more presentation do you have, Dr. Nolan?
Four minutes.
Okay. Representative Dabney.
Thank you. This may be a question for Mr. Strom or for the witness. I'm not sure. The witness just indicated that the cost to the state would be $4.7 million. Mr. Strom, would that come out of the education budget? Would that come out of taxes? Where would that come out of? And I guess my underlying question is, if we provide this additional property tax relief to folks in some of the rural districts that receive this aid, are we taking it away from, for instance, the education formula?
Mr. Strong.
Representative Dabney, one of the problems with issues like the sales ratio, the split committee jurisdiction like tax committee and education is for those very reasons they often go unaddressed. If this were included as part of the K-12 package, presumably it would be included in our K-12 target. If it were included in the tax bill, it would presumably be included in the tax target. In past years, sometimes these issues have been negotiated that will be carried in one bill, even though it's a change to the target level. Now that we're in a more formal world of committee resolutions, my guess is that if it were in our K-12 bill, it would be counted as part of our K-12 target. Now, remember, with a change like this, we have an aid target as well as an informal levy target. So to the extent that something we do lowers aid and increases levy or lowers levy and increases aid, we are essentially back to a neutral place, absent absent the results of the shift. So in other words, if we lower levies by $5 million in this committee in one pocket and increase aids by $5 million in the other, we're back to zero in our committee in terms of our combined target, our aid target and our informal levy target.
We lose spending.
Madam Chair, we don't lose spending to the extent that money doesn't fall off the table. If it's an aid that goes to a levy, the only difference is the accounting shifts that go with either the levy or the aid. The accounting shift on the aid side is we pay only 83% in the current year. The accounting on the levy side is if it's a shiftable levy, we'll gain the nearly 50% in aid savings for every dollar of levy increase. So if we're really just moving money from the aid to the levy column in a year when we have both an aid and a levy target, we're back to zero.
I think I understood most of that. Thank you.
We might run through that one more time later.
Are we on tape today?
We won't identify you, Representative. But as I look at this, if you're talking 4.7, and we do not have a formal fiscal note on this. We have your calculation, which is probably pretty thorough, but we don't have an official fiscal note. So we're talking $4.7 million per year. Correct?
Yes, yes. Beginning in the second year of the biennium.
$10 million in the biennium.
No. This would begin in the second year.
I know, but as you go forward.
As you go forward.
And then, of course, that will keep adjusting.
All formulas will keep adjusting, right. Yeah.
So next biennium, our out year, whatever our target is for out year, we would have to consider $10 million. So.
I would refer that to your able Tim Strom, and I don't know the answer to that.
Madam Chair, I would point out to you, too, that the exercise we went through that got to the $4.7 million, that would be on an as-if this was in effect and payable 2005 basis. So already we know this is a year out of date from when you'd actually be implementing it. And
so
what
the cost would be higher.
Would be different. I don't think
different. You don't
could
know
even
it would be
say higher.
Madam Chair, in general, the costs are going to be lower because the state aid is not is
levy values are going
up. Values are going up, and okay. So we have a relatively smaller pot of state aid that we're adjusting.
Okay. Representative Greiland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to understand this too, but my general principle about tax things, equity things, is I would always prefer that they be done in the tax committee because presumably they do understand these things. But also, anytime we monkey around with things like this, I always worry that we end up with money spent here that doesn't go for students, which is always our prime goal. But my question is, even though you said it was a neutral thing, does it delay though the shift being paid back in any way?
No, it doesn't affect that.
Yeah, no, Madam Chair, Representative Grattan, not really, no. I mean, it's only once we put the 84% on that it would affect that. But the debt levy is not subject to the property tax recognition shift. So to the extent that it's on that hand, if you're only changing what 1577 does, which is the debt levy and not other NTC levies, then adjusting the sales ratio really is a wash except for the maximum effort districts, and then there's some other things going on with the maximum effort districts, but otherwise you're just increasing state aid and lowering levies to those school districts.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grimes.
What I don't understand is how could we be increasing aid, but it's a neutral? That's
Madam Chair, Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, members, maybe if we look at the back page that Mr. Hines pointed out, that got the actual dollar amounts on it, and think about how we cost these things out and how you would track it relative to your target. So you can see on page 3 at the bottom, it's got state totals in each. Let's look at House File 1577 only, the middle one. So you see there's an aid change of $4.7 million and a levy reduction of $5.2 million. When you think about your targets, they are relatively fungible, your aid target and your levy target. In other words, if you should think about your targets almost in a revenue sense. If your target, for example, was the governor's spending in his original budget that was about $250 million of aid and $150 million of levy, you really should think about that as $400 million. How would you allocate $400 million? Regardless of source. And there are methods for allocating some of those things between aid and levy, mostly in programs where there's a mix of aid and levy. We can always tweak that mix to shift between aid and levy as you're putting your package together. So when you look at a bill like this and it says $4.7 million in aid, the way the shift comes into play is we have to pay 84% of that in the first year. So we pay about $4 million of that in the first year. So against your aid target, there's a $4 million cost in the first year. On your levy target, you actually have a savings of $5 million. So you can spend $5 million more on levy. So how would you make that neutral? Well, let's pick a program that's a mix, health and safety. If we change the equalizing factor to change the mix of that to put more of it on levy, you could save $4 million on health and safety and raise your levy on health and safety by the $5 million you saved here, and you're at zero. So you really, when you have an aid and levy impact of an individual bill or program, relative to your target, you should look at the sum. And the sum in this case is negative $5 million on levy and $4 million after the shifts on aid. So actually, adopting this bill actually saves you $1 million in total relative to your target.
Is that convoluted?
So, Madam Chair, one last question. So can we spend this this extra money? It's money in this committee. In other words, we would like this bill to be here. Never mind about the tax committee.
Representative Greiling, I think, though, that the tax committee should look at the bill.
Oh, yeah.
I have no idea what other ramifications there may be. And that was your original motion, I believe, was that it go to taxes. And I guess then after taxes, whether it comes back here or not is another question. I suppose that's up to taxes. They may like that. They're saving $1 million in levy. $5 million in levy. They don't track levies in the same way we do, though, right? Okay. Representative Hyde Griffin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I find this very interesting. And I will take this home this weekend, and I hope the bill's author will be available for some questions.
I hope you're not going to put her on, in front of a big meeting on a telephone hookup or something. I think this one would be a hard one to answer all the questions that go with it. But seeing no other questions, I think your motion is to move it to taxes. Personally, I feel it should be moved to taxes without recommendation because I think there's so much we don't know about the effects of this or the effects in other places. I just don't know what other effects this might have. It's very interesting, and obviously you gentlemen have done a ton of work on it.
Well, Madam Chair and Committee, I do thank you for all this time. These gentlemen and Tom Melcher and representatives from Revenue, other school districts really have taken a hard look at this issue, and it does affect a lot of school districts. So I thought it was worthy of introducing the option that made me the most nervous. I tried to be revenue neutral, but in the end, that wasn't looking so good. So we tried this one. I did talk to Brian Steves from the Department of Finance. He said a request arrived yesterday, so by the time this gets to taxes, we'll have the fiscal note.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to renew my motion to pass House File 577 without recommendation to the Committee on Taxes.
All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Very, very good presentation, gentlemen. I think that with time we will all understand it a little bit better. Thank you very much. And that is... anybody looked at the minutes yet? Representative Maslow has looked at the minutes. Any additions or corrections to Representative Maslow's minutes?
That's it.
Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Now, folks, we are meeting on Monday afternoon. We are going to lose at least one of our meeting times. We'll lose at least one meeting time next week. We lose Thursday for sure, obviously. I had originally heard that we were going to do the budget budget resolution on the floor on Wednesday. Now, I hear it may be Tuesday or Wednesday, I'm not sure, but either way, it's one of our hearing times. So if they do Tuesday, our meeting will automatically be moved to Wednesday. But we will have a Monday meeting after session.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Yeah. Thank you. Has thought been given as you know, as we get by the policy dates of also using that time for education finance, so we got two slots. I mean, it really would take some of the pressure off down the road.
That would help a lot, and that would happen after the 5th.
Okay.
Oh, we have another bill.
So that is a great idea. We will book the policy times. That might save us from evenings. We've also booked some evenings, I will let you know, because you know there will be a lot of bills coming to us at the end. Just Representative Biskins himself is sending over a bundle.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you. Yeah, Madam Chair, as I've mentioned previously, I can be bought.
Would you send over your price?
Madam Chair, I think it has something to do with the next committee meeting that's in this room. Starts with R and ends with O.
Oh. All right. Anyway, we are adjourned.